Welcome, everybody. It's Mark Steiner here on The Mark Steiner Show and on Soundbites, our way to look at food and our environment and our future. And we're going to explore something called the Baltimore Ecosystem Study that most of you and most of us have no idea what that is or where it comes from or even know that it exists. We're going to find out now. It's actually pretty fascinating given the courses we've been teaching at UMBC and watching these map overlays. They fit right over the maps we've been doing, so I'm fascinated by this particular study. We're joined in studio by Helen Glaser, came from 2 months in the Antarctic. Wow, that's interesting. A good friend of mine just did that as well, National Science Foundation Antarctic Artists and Writers Program. And her Baltimore Ecosystem Study Project concentrates on the Gwynns Falls watershed, which we'll be talking about. And Dr. J. Morgan Grove is scientist and team leader of the Forest Service at the Northern Research Station. In studio as well, joining us by phone, Dr. Shannon Ledoux, who is Associate Scientist of Disease Ecology at the Baltimore Ecosystem Study and the Carey Institute, and Dr. Chris Swan, Professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And all welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, this is, when I first opened this, I was kind of shocked that I didn't even realize the intensity of what was going on. So who wants to begin to describe what we're talking about here?
So I can jump in terms of what the Baltimore Ecosystem
Morgan
Study
Grove.
Is. Thank you. Baltimore Ecosystem Study is one of 25 long-term ecological research projects that are in the United States in the Arctic and Antarctica. And what they set out to do is to understand long-term change that occurs in the environment. One of the reasons why these started was because when we looked at how long studies were conducted to understand changes in ecological systems, we realized that they only went on for about 3 years. And a lot of change occurs over longer periods of time. And so the National Science Foundation decided that they were going to invest in research that went for longer periods of time to understand these longer changes in climate, sea level rise, changes in the way soils work, and so on. One of the big changes that occurred in the mid-1990s was to say that the dominant ecosystem in the world is urban ecosystems, yet we know very little about them. And so the National Science Foundation decided that they wanted to understand urban ecosystems, and they put out a request for proposals for sites to be selected. There were two sites that were selected. One was Baltimore. The other was Phoenix. And our modest ambition is to try to understand the social, the economic, and ecological change of the Baltimore region from about 1650 to 2050. So it's a modest endeavor to try to understand what's happening and where is the system going.
That's fascinating. As someone who's kind of followed the, at least in terms of maps, where this has gone and seeing us as this delta with rivers to where we are now, it's kind of a fascinating change over the last 400 years of who we are. But let me take a step backwards. This is what our listeners can understand. And again, I'm going to throw this out. Anybody can answer this because I'm not sure who's doing what here. I apologize. But this has a direct lineage with something called the Chicago School. When people think of the Chicago School, they think of really conservative right-wing economics. But that's not what we're talking about here. So what is that?
Well, the Chicago School was what's considered to be the first school of urban ecology that started in the 1920s. And it was an attempt to understand the massive changes that were going on in Chicago. It was really the rise of cities in the United States. You had massive migration into Chicago from people being displaced in the South from agriculture, and also massive emigration into the United States, Chicago being one of those places, from Eastern Europe. And it was an attempt of primarily sociologists who used ecological concepts to understand what was going on in the city and trying to understand what they term vice and prostitution,
vice,
money laundering, gangs. They also were trying to understand really the economic changes that were occurring, technological changes that were occurring. The invention of the elevator allowed for buildings to go taller. And they used ecological concepts that they had gotten from really the beginning of ecology. And one of the things that has come out of the Baltimore Ecosystem Study is to say that there's a new school of urban ecology that draws upon what we would like to think is the best economic, ecological, and social scientists that we have. And that's what we call the Baltimore School of Urban Ecology.
So I'm going to talk a bit about what your roles are in all this and just kind of flesh this out and kind of dive into it. Let me go to the phones and we'll come back to the studio here with Helen. So Shannon Ledoux, talk a bit about the work you're doing in this.
I started working with the Baltimore Ecosystem Study about 5 years ago. And my interest was at looking at how mosquito populations, mosquito communities, changed along the urban to rural gradient in the Glens Falls watershed. This was largely motivated from West Nile virus impacts in birds that suggested that birds, even if it's the same species of birds, are more susceptible to West Nile virus exposure in the city. And so we wanted to look at what the vector community, that is the mosquito community that transmits West Nile virus, looked like across that gradient. Also, there are a couple of different invasive species of mosquitoes that are increasing in populations in the Mid-Atlantic and in Baltimore County and Baltimore City right now. And there are a lot of interesting questions about how they're competing and maybe taking over habitat or shifting in habitat use across an urban gradient. So that's the focus of my work there.
And Dr. Chris Swan.
I suppose I've been involved with the BES for, I think, 8 years now. I'm an ecologist by training and classically trained in aquatic ecology. But with the Baltimore Ecosystem Study, I've turned my attention towards plants. And the context is understanding how species assemblages are created and maintained on vacant land. And vacant land is a problem in most cities. Buildings come down. They're covered with some topsoil and then planted. And in this is really obvious, it's obvious in Baltimore. Baltimore has more than 10,000 vacant lots. And so how we're asking questions about how species assemble and can we manipulate the types of plant species that we see in order to confer certain ecosystem services or improve environmental quality. And what I mean by that would be changes in soil fertility. Can we increase the attraction of pollinators? Can we increase their aesthetics? These questions aren't meant to answer long-term or provide long-term solutions, but before developers decide to come in and do something with these vacant lands, there's a lot of green space to be managed. Right now, we focus most of our attention in West Baltimore, but it's not a problem, isolated to that particular area. So that's one intensive project. The broader picture is trying to explain biodiversity in cities. And what I mean by biodiversity, I mean all the different types of plants and animals that we see. And so we take data sets that are very large, collected over a long period of time, in order to understand where is the biodiversity in cities, what do the species look like, and how might they change over time.
And Helen Glazer, I'm glad you're here in the studio. It's been a long time since we've seen each other. So so you're the artist in residence. What role is that in this?
Yeah, well, I was the artist in residence from October 2014 to October 2015. I guess I saw my role as one of sustainability and the environment are really important to me. Mm-hmm. My work has been focused on nature, and I've been really interested and curious about forms in nature and why they look the way they do. I thought the idea of looking at forms in nature in terms of how they're interacting with the urban environment and how people are interacting with nature sounded interesting to me. But I also felt as I got to know more about the study and started going to their meetings and going out with scientists, I realized that I was getting to see a lot of places that I had no idea had ever existed. And I was starting to see these places through the eyes of the scientist and felt like I could bring some of that to other lay people so that they could start to perceive what was going on in the environment in a deeper way.
So if you add other things you've been doing over the years in this project. A couple of things really struck me as I was kind of going through the book as quickly as I could and so reading some of the other pieces is that what does this have to do with a couple of things? Let me start one at a time. With the lives of the people of West Baltimore. I mean, so, you know, we have – it's because I think understanding our biodiversity, understanding the urban ecology, understanding the world around us helps us kind of figure out where to go and where people want to take this. But so what effect – do what effect is the interaction you have, A, with the people who live in West Baltimore, and B, what will the study do? What does it engender in terms of changing lives and communities?
Well, I think that there are several different ways, and Shannon may speak some more about some of her direct connections in her work with mosquitoes, and Chris can talk some about the vacant lots. But one of the things that we're really trying to understand is how do people affect the environment? How does the environment affect people? And when we say people, we can mean their public health. We can mean their individual health. We can mean how people get along, their social cohesion. We also mean in their sense of community, but we can also mean their economic development and prosperity. And one of the fundamental things that we're interested to know is, for instance, how can we use trees taking over vacant lots, lead to economic redevelopment, how can it improve people's lives? But also as we improve people's lives, how does it actually improve the environment? So there's kind of that direct connection at that community level about trying to restore, to rebuild neighborhoods. When we look at this in a long-term context, we see that there's been a long history of segregation that has existed in the city. Right. The impacts of redlining that has left enduring signature on the landscape, on people's neighborhoods. And so some of those data now are starting to be used for thinking about should the city have a policy on environmental justice. And our data are able to show not only the inequities that exist, but how did those inequities come to be and how do they come to persist, which then become instrumental to thinking about, well, if we want to go from redlining to greenlining, what are some of the things we got to worry about mm-hmm. in order to advance this? The people of West Baltimore are part of Baltimore City. There's going to be lots of changes that are coming to the city in terms of the heat waves that we're going to have, the amount of rain that we're going to have, trying to restore the environment to deal with the stormwater that we have. How do we become not only more sustainable but also resilient, prepared for these major events that are coming at us? And so our data and the knowledge that we have can be used for becoming better prepared into the future as well.
Shannon, can you pick up on that, especially since you talked about your work in the West Side with mosquitoes and how that fits into the question I asked?
Yeah. So in addition to kind of the broad scale look at mosquito populations and how they change over an urban to rural gradient, I have work that really targets, again, the vacant lots and the idea that different neighborhoods maintain or have different types of mosquito habitat. And so the mosquito infestations look different across neighborhood boundaries, even if the neighborhoods are right next door. You know, a lot of the mosquitoes that are currently bothering people, and when we ask people if they're bothered, 3 out of 4 say that they've changed their behavior and how they want to be outside because of the mosquito nuisance. But so even neighborhoods that are close together are very closely located can have very different mosquito problems. Many of the mosquitoes don't fly that far. And so we're really targeting very local, spatially explicit strategies for how people can manage the mosquito infestation on their block or in their neighborhood. We're obviously testing for virus and doing things to look at the risk of disease burden in these neighborhoods via the mosquitoes as a vector of disease. But we're also looking at the mosquitoes as a nuisance. I mean, if they are changing people's behavior so they don't want to be outside, then that has a lot of cascading effects on obviously how people use the environment and on recreation and health, which we know is linked to the nature exposure and outdoor exercise, but also on how they support the city's efforts to restore parks. the sustainability of green infrastructure. So we're looking at those connections and trying to work with communities to devise strategies to decrease the mosquito population, but in ways that, that different neighborhoods actually can support. And so in neighborhoods where people have backyards that they want to be out in and manage their own yards, you know, we have to help people learn about what is actually holding water, what is mosquito habitat, among the items that are in the yards they actually want and manage. And in other neighborhoods where you have a lot of vacant buildings and vacant lots, you don't have the same kind of yard-managed habitat. You have discarded habitat, and oftentimes that habitat isn't on any resident's personal property. It's on a vacant lot. And so that takes different strategies for understanding how to manage the mosquito infestations in those neighborhoods. This spring, we are working with Parks and People Foundation to fund a small grant program where neighborhoods in West Baltimore, in our focal neighborhoods, residents have been given the opportunity to apply for funds to do some project of their creation that they think will limit the mosquito populations. And we're going to do some sampling before and sampling after to see if any of these other ideas and strategies can make a difference, again, at these local scales.
So I'm curious, before I put it back to Helen, I want to kind of ask a larger question here about the future and what this might say to us. So, Chris, but you work in also in that same area, but you're working with offenders or ex-offenders in the community working on these lots. Is that right?
Yeah, so what we're doing are very large manipulations of plantings on vacant land. It's a huge, huge task. I was approached by a colleague out of Evergreen State College in
Washington, yeah,
to become involved with what's called the Sustainability and Prisons Network. And across the country, there are scientists that work with correctional facilities in order to make the practices more sustainable. And when I was approached, I have to be honest, this isn't something that I really wanted to take on. But what I quickly learned is that in exchange for providing some horticultural skills to inmates while they're inside, we could have inmate work crews come out and help install and maintain some of these plantings. And so we were able to engage which is essentially an underserved group or underserved demographic in some environmental science. We were able, and this has been going on now for 2 years. We're getting ready to gear up for the third year, where the inmates are involved with the planting, the site preparation, and the maintenance of the projects as they go on.
So, I have a lot of things are popping through my head here, but Helen, I was just curious. So, when you do your work in all of this, I mean, so how is the work you do? Is it in sculpture and whatever other art you're using? I mean, how does that interpret this work? Or is that what it does? And does it involve people other than yourself who maybe live in the neighborhoods you're talking about?
Well, I started taking photographs as source material, and some of them I printed as straight photos. Some of them I worked up as in a more manipulated fashion. I made them look like etchings. Well, let me just back up, is that one of the things that struck me, you know, it's a huge topic, so it took a while for me to figure out how to narrow it down. But I decided this whole idea of water as a connector of all these communities. So, you know, one of the first things I did was I went out with the stream sampling team, and then part of the long-term research that's being done, it's been done since, I think, 1997, is once a week, every week, a research scientist and his assistant go to 10 sites from Carroll Park up to Oregon Ridge. And they download data from all these stream gauges, and they also take water samples that are analyzed. And so there's all these years of data that are watching the stream flow. So I'm going with them, you know, with the rubber boots and wading back into these sites. And so I was thinking about that, you know, and I was thinking about the water that, you know, we kind of take for granted. We sort of see it without seeing it. One of these stream sampling sites is probably about a mile from where I live, and I had no idea. I'd gone over the overpass. I'd never really gone down and looked at the stream. You start seeing it from their point of view, and you're down there. Well, first of all, you know, it really brings home, especially in Carroll Park, where a lot of this water has been funneled underground through West Baltimore. And then the storm drains carry this trash. And there's this big pipe.
That we just saw happen in Baltimore. The dump that happened in the harbor.
Right. And so there's this big tunnel that there's a railroad bridge. And the water comes out of the tunnel. And one of the hydrologists from one of Morgan's colleagues took me over there. And he said, if you go on the other side of this bridge, you're in a tunnel. And it's taking the water from West Baltimore. Well, out there on the side where we were, the banks are festooned with plastic bags, styrofoam cups. And, you know, I took pictures of all these things. There's sewage fungus growing on some of the rocks. He pointed that out to me. I would not have recognized it. It doesn't smell like sewage, but he said that tells you it's there. Mm-hmm. So when I present these pictures and they're captioned and I'm explaining to people, look, this is what's happened. You know, that whole campaign, the whole gubernatorial campaign was going on and then, you know, where it just finished and, you know, where they were talking about the rain tax. And, you know, it's like people don't understand what the stormwater problem is about. So maybe bringing this to them, you know, could have an impact that just hearing we have a stormwater problem, what does that mean? If you see these piles of garbage, it shocks people. Likewise, when I went around with Shannon's mosquito team, I went around with them one day when they were doing larvae sampling, and they were going, you know, every place we saw, say, a rubber tire that somebody had thrown.
Right.
All of them had larvae in them. And also going in, you know, some of us have driven down those streets where you see the boarded up buildings, but we don't get out of our car and walk around in the alley. Why would we? But if you're going out looking for mosquito habitat, that's what you're doing. And
right.
What I was seeing is that, like, some sort of this street, you can't even see what's going on. The backs of these buildings are just falling apart. There's holes in the roofs, and the trees are taking them over, and they're like ruins. And that's
right.
Yeah. So
right.
They're like ruins, like Roman ruins, you know, with columns, and except that, like you'd see in Italy, except that these are houses that are 100 years old, and nature is just taking them back.
So in all of this, I'm really curious about what it says about, I mean, our future and what we do. I mean, I think it's important to follow and have these urban ecological studies following who we are, how we've gotten to this place, what's happening to us in the water, how this environment is affecting us and the land, and all those 10,000 vacant lots. But the question seems to me is, when you just sit among yourselves talking about the issue of what you discovered, does this work tell you about what has to be done, about where this takes us, about where it could take us, where people could take it?
Well, I think that we don't – it's not just a scientist sitting around talking amongst
themselves. I'm saying is – but when you look at this data, what is it telling you about what this can say to us, what we should be wrestling with, where should it be taking us is what I'm saying. I want to apply this practically.
Right. I think it gives us some great concerns about what's coming at us, particularly with the questions about climate change, sea level rise, flooding that we're going to have, the heat that we're going to have, the economic challenges that are so profound in so many of these neighborhoods. And that's on one hand. On the other hand, what we're also seeing is that city agencies and nonprofits we go and work in other cities, right? And we connect with other cities and we go with our partners from the Department of Planning, Department of Public Works, Recreation, Parks, and in many other cities that you might think of as very desirable places to live, are really impressed with the leadership that you see in the government agencies here in the city. And what they're doing is they have some very – Department of Planning has some very far-reaching ideas about where to go in a comprehensive way about getting ready, adapting to climate change and how it's going to address questions of people and prosperity and place, how it's going to address environmental justice. And they're working with the other city agencies like Department of Public Works. And they're using some of our data, but it wouldn't be a ding against them if they didn't use our data. But they are asking questions about it. If they do this, what's likely to happen? Not what's going to happen, what's likely to happen. If they do something in this way, what is likely to happen? So, you know, if we continue going the way we've been going, things aren't looking good. But I think that if we go, where do we want to go and be in the next 30 years, I think that actually things could be pretty exciting about where the city's going
to
be.
You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on the home of the 2016 Baltimore Mayoral Debate, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Also broadcast on Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM. I'm speaking to participants from the Baltimore Ecosystem Study about their project, which is a consortium of long-term research projects examining Baltimore's ecosystem. On our way to break, I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn more about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Or at SteinerShow.org is the Maryland State Education Association's banner. You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on the home of the 2016 Baltimore Mayoral Debate, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Also broadcast on Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM. I'm speaking to participants from the Baltimore Ecosystem Study about their project, which is a consortium of long-term research projects examining Baltimore's ecosystem. I'm joined by Helen Glazer, who is a 2014-2015 Baltimore Ecosystem Studies Artist in Residence. You can see her work at helenglazer.com. I'm also joined by Dr. J. Morgan Grove, scientist and team leader for the Forest Service at the Northern Research Station. Joining us by phone is Dr. Shannon Ladeau, associate scientist of disease ecology at the Baltimore Ecosystem Study and the Carey Institute, and Dr. Chris Swan, professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Systems at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I mean, I'm not saying that nobody in this room needs to endorse a candidate, far from it, but we are in the midst of this mayoral race in Baltimore, right? And so, you know, when you look at these things, let me turn back to the phone here with the Shannon and Chris and Shannon. Just, you know, when you watch the machinations going on, see the research you all are doing, what comes out of that? I mean, what are the questions we should be talking about that come out of your work that say, this is what we're learning? We have to figure out a way to address this, whether it is the lots, the mosquitoes, what's happening to our water, the abandoned. The abandoned buildings that are being reclaimed by the land and trees themselves, but there are hundreds of thousands of people in Baltimore City who live in the middle of that. So, what are the questions? Let me start with Shannon. That we should be asking here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the thing that has struck me is the scope of it, and so there are a lot of really amazing organizations and people that are constantly doing things across all of these neighborhoods to make their block or to make a block better, more sustainable, safer, and yet there's always three other blocks that are, you know, in just a little bit worse shape, and it's just, you know, so moving out from here, there's a lot of good intentions and there's a lot of really amazing opportunities to make the city greener and do so in a way that's sustainable and supports human health as well as ecosystem health. But it's not an easy task, and partially it's not an easy task because this abandonment and kind of isolation of some of these neighborhoods has been going on for so long now.
Right.
And there's a lot of internal feedback. You know, it, It's not particularly poignant to say, but it's still true that, the poor neighborhoods are disproportionately bearing the brunt of the city's shrinking population and infrastructure decay. And again, it's not poignant. It's not just Baltimore. That's everywhere. But that's also going to be where you expect climate change to have the biggest impact on the residents, and where you expect mosquitoes to have the biggest impact on the residents. And
right.
In a city, you're at a novel spatial scope where you have things very close together. So you have it's amazing that you have neighborhoods that might not be as aware of the level of degradation and abandonment because it's really within a kilometer. But people don't go there if they don't have to, and so you don't see it.
They don't see it. And Chris, I mean, I'm curious what policy changes could come out of things like this and ideas that we should push and be talking about and wrestling with. I mean, when you're out looking at these 10,000 vacant lots or parts of them, I mean, that what to do there has a great deal to do with the future of the people's lives who live in those communities, and has to do with the future of the city and what we can do, what can be created in its wake. What comes to your mind?
So the project that we're doing was actually born out of a policy the city has. The city has a sustainability action plan, which is a very large document. And in that document, they speak to things like biodiversity, the reduction of invasive species,
right,
the proliferation of native species, the improvement of soil and stormwater management. All of these things already articulated in documents that the city has come up with. And so when I take a look at these vacant lots, I see an opportunity there to test some ideas to see if we can directly address those goals that the city has already set out and set aside as important. And so looking at these lots, to me, anything we do is probably going to be an improvement, but we're also scientists and experimentalists. So we're trying to figure out what is the best thing that we can do. And so we're trying to actually kill multiple birds with one stone, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
We're working in people's backyards in environments that don't look nice. We're trying to make them look nice, while at the same time we're testing ideas that are directly related and applicable to what the city and therefore the citizens have supported right now on the ground.
So And I was thinking about this also in the context of just what the city used to look like, what it was like, whether it was in the last century or even before that. And I worked in this project with some students from Morgan State University who were on our show about unearthing the rivers. Right? In Baltimore, and they had this idea around Central Avenue, and we have a picture here in our office we haven't hung up yet, which is from the early part of the 1900s. That shows the Gwynns Falls snaking its way down through the city and past the train station in this kind of rapids happening in the midst. And so what our city was.
Yeah. I found a map from a broadside from, I think, probably around the 1890s when they were building the North Avenue streetcar, because that's in the map. And it was advertising this area right around Sandtown, Winchester, saying, what was it, beautiful, elevated location, healthful, great opportunity. They were trying to sell a new development. And there was a stream running through it called Mill Race.
Mill Race, right. And that runs all the way through Gwynns Falls Park and into where Security Boulevard now is, where that Mill Race goes.
But it's not there now.
No,
if you
it's
look
gone.
At Google Maps,
right.
it's all
right.
covered with.
Right.
And these buried streams are actually something to pay a lot of attention to. So there was a professor at Penn, Ann Spurn, who was working over in Kensington in West Philadelphia. And what they found was.
Oh, I know Kensington, yeah.
Okay, so most of the areas of abandonment. Going back to abandonment, were those houses that were built on the buried streams. because they had the basements that were collapsing. They had the basements that were flooding,
right.
And it led to the decline. And she went to the Philadelphia Department of Public Works and said, hey, you've got a problem. And she described this relationship. And they said, oh, there's no such thing. And then she got them to reconstruct where the buried streams were. She mapped out where all the vacant homes were. And the vacant homes snaked in line with where the buried streams were. And so that's an open question in Baltimore, too.
We haven't done that here yet, have we?
Well, we're actually thinking about putting together all the history of the buried streams for Baltimore and seeing whether or not this relationship links. And so it's this, no pun intended, this undercurrent, right? This underground threat. And sure, there's abandonment that occurs because of the changes in the economy and many of the things that have challenged the city. But there are also these long-lasting ecological imprints upon the landscape that we see as well. And we should reconsider whether or not we ever want to put a house back on one of those.
And I mean, we have worked over the years with many community activists on this program, and one of them, a group of people who've done artistic work and theater work around the Highway to Nowhere. And people like Sheila Gaskins and others and people who work around with her. And they actually discovered a stream and a spring in that neighborhood, the people you always used to get their water from. I mean, and so that is real. So the question is, you know, because I've seen the and I've looked through the report, Chris, that you were talking about, the sustainability report. And it's an interesting report. And one sidebar was when they questioned people in some East Side and West Side neighborhoods, they said, we're doing a sustainability report. And the people's response was in the neighborhoods, why, you want to sustain this? And which the answer is no. So sustainability has different definitions depending who you are. But the question is, so we have these reports, and it's an interesting report. I mean, it's very thorough under the people who did it. But so if you take that, and take the work that you're uncovering, no pun intended as well, and what you're discovering, that's what I'm really interested in, where this takes us. So I keep coming back to the same question, because I think it becomes a critical juncture where people in the community actually know the facts that scientists and ecologists pull together around what's happening in our world, but then how that's used to really implement things like a sustainability report rather than having it be a piece of work on a shelf that nobody listens to unless you're talking about a multimillion-dollar development you want to give TIFFs and pilots to.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, what some of these neighborhoods look like in 1920 and 1930, you don't want to go back to, because in part they were completely overbuilt. I mean, they had huge amount. It's very densely built. And you know, to have any recreation area was to go play in the middle of the street.
Right, right.
And
right.
So to imagine, where do we want to go in terms of a safe and a healthy, a prosperous neighborhood? What kinds of density are we going to have? How can we do that without greenwashing and displacing the residents who live there? How can we do it and provide jobs? And what kind of jobs are people going to have? Back in 1910, there wasn't really such a thing as major industry, right? You had lots of businesses. And if you look in Baltimore, there were lots of neighborhoods that had a factory, like within the context.
Right.
So how are we going to – do we go back to that, you know, as part of the economic development? And in our team, it's in addition to sociologists and ecologists, we also have economists. And so one of the things that we're studying is, if you just green neighborhoods, are you going to get there, or do you also have to remove this huge oversupply of housing that you have or vacant land? So what's that mix to work with these – neighborhoods, and what did neighborhoods even think of as greening? Because in the sustainability plan, there's no one definition of sustainability of greening, and many folks have not had much of an experience with sort of the green environment in a long time. So we're going to need to work and respond to what they want to have happen, and it's by our understanding how these things come together that we can work with the city and the neighborhoods to say, well, where do you want to go? How can we get there, and how can we do it in a way that economically you're not displaced because other people think it's a great place, they move in, and now you can't afford to live there anymore? So these issues are complex, but I think our understanding – we're trying to understand how these things fit together so that we can work with neighborhoods and with the city to get there.
So I'm just kind of pushing this notion a bit more, and I'm curious for all the other three of you, Shannon, Chris, Helen. Just, I mean, how would you add to what to what Morgan was just saying in terms of what could come next? I mean, how this the work you're doing becomes something, not that it's not doing that now in a sense, but becomes living and breathing, again, no pun intended, and involves the people in these communities in our city and throughout our city about the kind of change it could, you know, it could embody. Because, I mean, people are always wrestling with this. I mean, there's so many people who have ideas about the vacant land that's in our city and turning it into parks and farms and places for families to gather and building kind of new sustainable communities people can live in Baltimore and creating jobs that are green. And so people think this is all pie in the sky. So, I mean, so the question is, for people like Chris, is it pie in the sky or is there some other reality here?
For my part, you know, I agree with what Morgan was saying, and I think that it's really easy to be overwhelmed with the pie in the sky nature, but it is also really important to recognize that it has to be this incremental change for the most part that allows residents in place to adjust and participate in the change that's going on in their neighborhoods. And that there's no one fit for each neighborhood. You know, I think there's a lot of suspicion. As Maureen said, a lot of people aren't, in some of the neighborhoods, a lot of people aren't as familiar with walking out the front door and having green be something that's desirable.
Right.
You know, in many of these neighborhoods, if you see a tree, it's because nobody's taking care of that plot of land. And so, you know, just going in and planting a bunch of trees isn't likely to be as effective in that neighborhood as working with the people to figure out what it is about nature that they would appreciate, and, you know, maybe introducing trees in a different way than you might in another neighborhood. But it has to be a community involved, integrated project that kind of proceeds with resident input.
Exactly. I mean, that and that's the key part is the last sentence you said, I think. Helen, you look like you're about to say something on this.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, I've been living in the county for a long time, and, you know, so my perspective, like seeing the stream and realizing that it continues down from the county all the way down into the city, that it's all connected, so that the border between county and city is sort of artificial in a way, and kind of meaningless in terms of the Gwynn's Falls. But I think that people in the county sort of see the city sometimes as that's the city. They have their problems. We have ours. But, you know, we're I would hope that people would kind of see it as more continuous and that we're more of a region and that, you know, that these issues, that they would care, that they wouldn't just see it as something that stops at the county line and is not their concern.
Right. And that's been a problem for a long time on a number of levels. I mean, race and class issues are deep, and people, that's one of the reasons people didn't want some people did not want a rail system that went into the county and further up. And part of the reason we have a beltway and a green space between. I mean, there's all kinds of things that are part of this complexity.
I think, too, if, you know, we can get caught up on, as we think about these neighborhoods, as we try to think with these neighborhoods.
Right, that's better.
If I may. is rather than think about things like urban agriculture or urban orchards and things like that, think about it in a little bit of a systems way, which is, If we can take what we know socially, economically, ecologically, and cut the costs of any one neighborhood, electricity, water, taking care of the stormwater, if we cut costs by 50%, that's a radical change. And this is something I learned from work in Detroit. Their notion is if we can capture 10% of the profit, 10% of the profit of big farm, of big agriculture, and produce our own food here, if we can go into our own production of our own alcohol, like think about how many breweries were in Baltimore in 1900. it was a lot more than Budweiser, Miller, and I don't know if we're allowed to say brands, but you know,
you can say brands. Yeah.
So you have that. So if you start to think about
beer was one.
That's right. So if you think about all the things that we could make locally and capture 10% of whatever that was nationally, and cut our costs, so just get 10%, cut our costs by 50%, and really in a sense, return the local control, the local production, the local consumption, we would radically change the city. And so then you start thinking about the things, like what things do I need in order to do either one of those things? And you're seeing that in places like Detroit. You're seeing that in places like Baltimore, where they're saying, in a sense, let's go back to the entrepreneurial city that we had in 1900, and this could be a transformation to our city. So it's changing the way we think about it. And then how do we use this growing knowledge that we have about how cities work in order to try to get there?
So I mean, that's why the fascinating parts of this, the work you're doing is I'm always, you know, when I was a student studying, let's say, anthropology in college or something, I was more interested in applied anthropology than just studying anthropology. I mean, how do we take the stuff that we know and really begin to work so that it becomes transformative, you know, working with community and coming up with these ideas, because community understands things you guys will never understand, and you understand things they don't understand because of the nature of your work. And the marriage of those ideas is where things change. I can imagine, Chris Swan, having that many of the men and that you work with who are personally incarcerated working on these lots have stuff to teach you, and they're in the process. They're learning a great deal about what the possibilities are once they get out.
One of the things that I will jump in here about as we try to find Chris that he told me that we learned is as they were doing these vacant lots, the inmates, and many of the inmates come from these neighborhoods, said, you got to put up a fence. You got to put up a fence or no one's going to take responsibility. No one's going to like respect these pieces of land. So they put up these split rail fences, right, at the suggestion of the inmates. And what they found was the vacant lots that they had with the split rail fence had much less trash, much less dumping, much less walking across. They had signs of respect that the same kind of lots without the split rail fence were very different. And the split rail fence wasn't keeping anything in or out.
No, right. Right? No, they don't do that. Right.
But Chris had never thought of that.
Unless you're a donkey.
Right.
Even
exactly.
Then.
Well, some people might think. But, you know, I think that, you know, that was a great – we learned a ton from working with the communities because they have some really – specific ways that they understand how the cities work and their neighborhoods work.
I'm sorry, Shannon, let me bring you back in. I mean, again, let me just probe you a little deeper about those thoughts as you kind of do your work. I know there's a give and take between community and research, so I'm curious how this conversation fits into that.
Yeah, you know, it's been a really interesting learning process for me to work with the community to grow the research. And so we have very clear questions that we wanted to address with the research, but both methods and kind of the depth of those questions have undoubtedly been shaped by our interactions with the community. You know, and I think Chris would say the same thing. And one of the things that's really exciting about the work we all have going in West Baltimore is the opportunity to test some of our hypotheses in ways that are really meaningful for the local community. And so the vacant lot restorations that Chris has done, the plantings, are really a rigorous test of ecological theory. And they're making gardens with community input in the middle of these residential neighborhoods for community use, which is really amazing. And likewise, we're going to work with the communities to figure out what do they think are the biggest, what do they think are the important changes that could be made to make it more comfortable outside vis-a-vis trash and mosquitoes? And, you know, there are some very different perceptions across neighborhood boundaries, and we can use those to test our understanding of the science in ways that we wouldn't have thought up ourselves, which is really exciting.
And Helen, just for a couple of seconds here, I mean, your thoughts about where you take this with your artwork.
Well, one thing I do want to say is that if you want to see the photographs, you can go to bit.ly /BaltoEcoStudy. So that's BaltoEcoStudy. And I've put a big selection of them up on Flickr there. And the exhibition that I had in October at the end of this project, I have installation shots of that too. And they're all captioned so that, you know, that lives on. And, you know, I think one of the things that's been great for me is I've been interested in science and applying insights of science to understanding the natural world, but the opportunity to really interact with scientists. This was the first time I really went out with them in the field. And when I was in Antarctica, I continued that. And so I really feel like this is something that I'll be doing for a while. I mean, I just feel like I get so much. I understand more about what I'm looking at. I can convey it better. And it opens my eyes, and I hope to open other people's eyes too.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. I think this is the beginning of what we're going to try to do here with you all on this program. The Baltimore School of Urban Ecology, this whole question of Baltimore Ecosystem Study. Helen Glazewicz is artist in residence, 2014-2015. Dr. J. Morgan Grove is a scientist and team leader of the Forest Service and the Northern Research Station. Dr. Shannon Ledeau, associate scientist of disease ecology at the Baltimore Ecosystem Study and the Carey Institute. And Dr. Chris Swan, as well as before, professor in the Department of Geography and Environmental Systems at UMBC. Thank the four of you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are productions of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Delmarva Public Radio is Christopher Rank. Our interns are Sienna Greaves, Morgan Barber, Manifa Wilson, and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. The podcast of Mark Steiner Show, share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org, or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. You can also learn about Soundbites and listen to past episodes at soundbitesradio.org. And for your home of the 2016 mayoral debate, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.